doing it since the 90s. And so you could just say, oh, they keep doing it. But what I'm trying to say is if you parcel out and you try to separate it out, employer-friendly measures, right, that make it easier to lay off, make it easier to cut labor costs, versus employee-friendly measures, right, which are designed to make work life better, to give employees more choices, right, to create more diversity, more equality, right, they turn the corner, right? This is blatantly obvious to the opposition. They say, this is odd. We've been saying this for 20 years, and suddenly you guys figured out, that this might be a good idea. And it is different when it comes from a conservative party, because their ultimate goal is not equity for equity's sake, right? It's for economic growth and for childbirth, right? For fertility, right? Those are the two big goals. But they've realized that actually the best way to get there are these actually more what you might call progressive policies. So, in terms of the question, will Japan really do this and will it work? We just don't know yet, right? I think that they're moving in the right direction, but I do think it has the potential, and it's very market crafty in the sense that if it works, it's a set of policies that's designed to improve productivity and to improve social welfare, right? And so it's where that trade-off actually doesn't exist. And it doesn't exist particularly in the Japanese case because you've got a population that's declining and you have a labor market that's very tight, right? And so if you want to have increased productivity, this is what Abe has figured out, and you don't want mass immigration, right, then you need to increase female workforce participation. So that's one of the key goals. Now, if you want to increase work, you're going to have to make the situation a little bit better for them, right? So that means that you're going to have to attack gender inequality, right? And you're going to have to make the workplace a more reasonable place where, right, let's say a mother could think about staying after childbirth, right, because she would actually be able to go home, right, at the end of the day. So I think it's a win-win. Intellectually, I think it's fascinating. I did research in September. I'm actually pretty impressed I don't think it's just a papering over. I mean, what I mean by this is, for example, Japan has an equal employment opportunity law in 1986. So on the books, Japan looks great. They all understand that didn't necessarily happen, right? In other words, that the law and the reality are removed, and so that this time they can't just say okay, equal pay for equal work and wave a wand. So my point is they get that, right? And so the ministry in interesting places, odd places that you wouldn't imagine, like Keidanren, this is the employers' organization, are really on board in terms of follow up, taking surveys, monitoring. I mean, there are limits in terms of personnel, right? The ministry just doesn't have enough people to go raid every company. But they have a whole like bonus system. They give you a little, three stars, right, if you have good gender equity policies, and you get published on their website and all this. So I think they get it. So the final challenge is implementation, and that's where I think both at the national level and at the company level, there's going to have to be some enforcement. I say kind of flippantly, if they really want everybody to go home, they're going to have to turn off the lights and lock the doors. And the same with, at the government level, there's going to have to be some enforcement. Because they, like I said, their ambitions are very ambitious, but the enforcement is at this point, you get administrative guidance, right? Which means they say, we don't like that, right? For a lot of these things, right? And so they might have to go a little further.
Zach Ox, I'm a master's student in philosophy and social policy, and I focus on wealth metaphysics.
That sounds great.
A lot of your stuff seems to look at tweaking and guiding existing markets, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts or possibly examples on what a government could do regulation-wise to create a market that does not exist on its own for future purposes.
Okay, another great question. So when I say market craft makes whatever more dynamic markets, a lot of what I'm talking about is competition, but I'm also talking about scope, which, in other words, exactly what you're talking about, expanding markets into areas where you didn't have markets for, right? And that's kind of the ultimate example of market craft, right? Because most market craft is kind of evolutionary, where you've got various policies and regulations, and decisions are made, hopefully, in the direction of enhancing whatever the vitality of, or the level of competition or the effectiveness of a market. But there's another category, which I do talk about. I didn't talk about today in the talk, but in the book, I call this fabricated markets, right? Where there's actually a moment of creation, right? You know, on day one, there is no market. On day two, there is, right? And somebody has to figure out how. An example of that would be cap and trade, right? Another example would be a spectrum auction, right? So there are more and more cases of literally creating markets, right? And again, it depends on what you're trying to do, but you can. We now have the knowledge, we have both the IT capacity and also the intellectual capacity to really fine-tune markets. So again, if we go to the example of a spectrum auction, you can design that auction to achieve certain public policy goals, right? So one goal might be revenue maximization, right? You want to make a lot of money because this is money that's going to go into the public purses and can be used for something good, hopefully, right? But you might have other policy goals like geographical equity concerns, access concerns, right? And you can kind of program them into, right, the way you structure the market, right? So it's a good example of how you can actually craft markets to achieve public policy goals, right? So I think that's absolutely a possibility. It's something that, again, both sides of the aisle need to think about. And like I said, it's only going to become more a part of our lives going forward because we have greater capability to fabricate markets than we did, whatever, 10 or 20 years ago. Yes.
My name is Tian Zhang. I work for the Institute of International Finance.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, what's your take on the Dodd-Frank law? Like, do you think it's a policy that, as a market craft, it helps build the institution of the financial market? And what's your take on the recent deregulation legislation?
So it's... So I think market craft is essential to financial markets, obviously. It's easier to critique mm-hmm. regulation pre-2008 than to say exactly what the solution should be.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I already said this, but it's very easy to say that we had a massive failure of market craft mm-hmm. That led up to the crisis. And while I do think that financial crises are inevitable, I don't think this one was. I mean, I think in the sense that it didn't have to be. I mean, you know, markets have cycles, and we have recessions, mm-hmm. but we did not need, you know, that there were policy errors, and that created this particular crisis, that and with this particular level of damage, right? So I do think there was a failure of market craft that really had devastating consequences for our economy. I realize none of that has answered your question. I think Dodd-Frank moves in a positive direction,
mm-hmm.
in a pretty major way. Not perfect,
mm-hmm.
But we have a situation where you have higher capital requirements, right, which is critical to the stability of the financial system. You have a set of incentives that push financial institutions away from having kind of risk-taking activities as the core of their profit stream. Right,
mm-hmm.
So that's huge, right? Because
mm-hmm.
that's a lot of what Red did. Is financial institutions where you know, you can call it rent seeker, whatever, where the whole game mm-hmm. was to make risky bets at the expense of the public, and that's become much more difficult under the Dodd-Frank regime.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, from a market craft perspective, I think the idea that at least there are regulators who are supposed to be looking at the picture as a whole. I think is critical, right? Because part of the problem in the United States is we have a very fragmented regulatory system in terms of finance, right? And so, and that's not how financial markets work. There's lots of spillage. And that was one of the mistakes that was made, because people said, well, hedge funds, that's a bunch of grown-ups that they're, you know, they, maybe they are playing roulette, but that's not going to, you know, it's not going to spill over to the rest of the economy. So I guess I would highlight those three pieces, right? Kind of overall, right? Market governance perspective on systemic risk, yes. Right, that wasn't there before, better capital requirements, and more detailed rules that are designed, and supervision, designed to push financial institutions away from kind of the core of their revenue stream being risk-taking towards just boring banking, right? Now, having said that, I don't think that the current reforms, and I, you know, to be honest, I've been asking this question myself around town this week, trying to get the details. But it doesn't seem like what's happening in terms of the Dodd-Frank reforms is the total gutting that the critics of the reforms might fear, right? In other words, there's some reasonable adjustments. So I actually don't think this. If you're worried about the stability of the financial system, this round is not the one to worry about. It's the next round, right? Does that make sense? The further you get away from a financial crisis, the more there's more likelihood there is for deregulating relaxing regulation to the point that you are creating risk. I don't think we're there yet, but we should stay vigilant.
We're going in that direction.
Yes, sir.
Hello, my name is Ko Hirano. I'm a reporter at Japan's Kyoto News Agency, based in DC. So happy to see you, Professor Vogel.
And it's great to see you.
Yes, my question is not really academic, but how do you assess President Trump's plan to impose tariffs on the steel and aluminum imports? The president said that tariffs are necessary for national security grounds, but do you think imports from Japan, for example, pose a threat to U.S. national security? Do you think U.S. allies such as Japan should be exempted from this measure? Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to see you. I was briefly a reporter myself for the Japan Times, and one of my jobs, I mean, a million years ago, was to translate the Kyoto Wire, because in those days it only came in Japanese. So it's a good thing that now it's bilingual. And in fact, there's a good incentive structure, because if we could come up with a good article idea, you know, they kind of let us go out. You had to do about 10 pitches before they finally. But if not, you know, it's like sit down and translate. To your question, I'm not a big fan of the current tariffs. I do think that there's been a healthy debate, although sometimes hysterical, about whether the free trade theories that we all learned in school are really valid in their original form, right? In other words, that we might have underestimated the damage the trade can do to particular communities, particular sectors, right? So I actually think that's valid. And also, I think, maybe more to the point, we're seeing incredible political consequences, right, of a free trade regime. So given this point in time, and as you can tell, I'm not a trade economist, but I think my solution, my prescription would actually be very simple, which would be take a break, right? In other words, don't try to move the trade agenda forward too aggressively. I'm not saying like everything, but going backward is not a good idea, right? I mean, I think the essence of trade theory is still right, which is that overall, right, it helps the dynamism of the economy, if you think bilaterally for both countries. And obviously there are certain sectors or certain regions that get hurt, right? The best way to do that is through positive market craft, right, in the affected region rather than protectionism. And obviously in this case, I mean, there's huge political ramifications, there's the possibility of trade war, so I just would not support what the government, the American government is doing now. So it wouldn't even be a matter of exceptions, right? I don't personally think this is a good idea. Do I think it's a national security risk? No.
So Japan should be exempted?
No, I'm saying there shouldn't have been any tariffs in the first place.
For anyone.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
So what's
there's a lot of things that the American government could do, right, to strengthen our industrial base, to make our society more equitable, to improve services, to improve training, right, to invest in getting skills in the areas that are most impacted. There are a lot of things you could do. This is not the best solution.
Have you written or thought about electricity capacity markets, which have been specifically people doing market craft in that area, trying to solve the missing money problem, trying to incentivize suppliers to put new capacity online? But so far, the experience, I think, worldwide is it hasn't worked. What has happened is all the new capacity is the cheapest stuff that you can buy at the highest price. They haven't found a way to incentivize, well, if you know what I'm talking about.
I do know what you're talking about.
It's all driven by renewable energy, and it's something that's come in strictly because of that. They've been doing, I mean, UK, Europe, Germany, everyone has been trying.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm an engineer. I'm sorry.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
That obviously means you know a lot of the substance issues much better than I do. But electricity markets is a case in my book for both the U.S. and Japan. So I do look at that. I think it's a nice illustration of market craft. It's maybe one of the cases where it's most obvious because there's no way you creating a market in electricity is incredibly technically complex, right? Because energy, you know, basically can't be stored. I mean, it can't be stored efficiently, so that you've got to, you know, you've got to match, the supply and demand. And there's a lot of perversities in the market that make it tricky to design it well. Most obviously, California, right? That the California energy electricity crisis was the product of bad market craft in electricity markets. Having said that, I don't know if it can be done perfectly, and as you can tell, I'm not an expert, but if you look, it can certainly be done better, right? I mean, if you compare the original California attempt to some of the East Coast regional markets that seem to be working better. So I think that the design is actually quite critical, I guess I would say electricity markets, if crafted well, can deliver efficiency benefits, but there are real risks, right, if you get it wrong.
So, the table you showed us, there are multiple variables, and one of the variables you were looking at was, I believe, norms. So, the Japan, for example, norms, mm-hmm. Right? So, I don't know how we can try to, craft or regulate norms for like the culture that is embedded in the Japanese market. So for example, even if you want to change like the culture or norms of the working place, you can't, for example, leave work even though you have nothing to do if you're older or, boss is not leaving the office. So even if there's like some, if that's not productive or inefficient and the problem, but if that's like embedded in like Japanese culture, like how does your theory tells us about fixing that kind of like norm embedded like problems that is in the society?
I mean, basically I agree with the premise. That's why the way I would describe what's happened in Japan is there's more change on the left and less change on the right, and that explains some of the effects. Like I didn't talk so much about corporate governance, but corporate governance is a case where there's been dramatic change on the legal side. So the laws have changed, the regulations have changed. How have Japanese companies actually adjusted? It's not that it hasn't been effective at all. It's just that they have basically tried to adjust as much as possible in form rather than substance. That's because they don't want to change their business practices and their basic norms have not changed, right? So that's the reality. So I think the main prescriptive answer would be not to try to change norms, but to try to change laws and regulations in ways that reflect an understanding of the underlying business practices and norms. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, for example, let's say that a particular Japanese sector is fundamentally oriented towards collusion, right? They all know each other, they all wink, they don't want to compete. Then if you had a formal deregulation, then you should be able to predict that you're not going to get competition because formal regulation will be replaced by implicit collusion. Does that make sense? Maybe that's not a very happy example, but I think you get my point, is that you have to craft the policies with the existing practices and norms in mind. Having said that, I think it's much harder to change things on this end, but I don't think it's impossible. And if anybody was going to give it a try, it would be the Japanese government. My mentor at Princeton historian Sheldon Guerin wrote this book about molding Japanese minds, which was about the Japanese government's attempts actually to change social organization and norms, right? To get to persuade people to save more, because the savings was critical to investment in the post-war period, right? To really get people to think differently. Does that make sense? And also to mobilize various like neighborhood associations and housewife associations to mobilize on that behalf. And at a kind of a more smaller level, they're definitely trying to do that with the work style reform. I don't know if it'll work or not. I mean, I was joking about the locking doors and turning off lights, but one of the things that really sparked the debate in Japan about working hours was a case of a suicide by a woman at Dentsu, the top advertising agency, right, from overwork, right? So there's a death by overwork. Karoshi is a very well-known phenomenon in Japan, and so that case prompted people to say, you know, this is going too far. And in the Dentsu isolated case, not surprisingly, apparently the response has been quite dramatic. I mean, you know, for obvious reasons, that they're getting all this attention. So there, some people really are literally closing the doors, locking people out of work. At a much more modest level, like I said, all this implementation and the industry associations and unions is their kind of way to kind of change norms. And I think, at least in the Japanese case, the government's signaling, I mean, you can make fun of it, but I think it does have some effect, right? If nothing else, let's say you're at a company and you want to leave early, right? The fact that the government has mandated that as a goal, that your industry association has mandated that as a goal, gives you at least a little bit of cover. Right? Or if you're someone in the company who always wanted to, let's say you're a personnel manager, you've always wanted to do this, right? Or move in that direction. Now you have some backing, right? So I'm not predicting revolution, but I am saying that they're actually trying to change those things, and there probably will be some modest progress.
As another question, thinking about the discussion here, I'm curious to hear if there is a place maybe for multilateral market craft. There are many cases maybe we can discuss, but one that pops in my mind is maybe a TPP and Japan's role in it, and how might that kind of take the market craft ideas be applied in the multilateral or international stage when different countries, maybe with widely different domestic market compositions, might work together to hammer out a larger scale market that different kinds of markets can interact in. So what might your thoughts be on that?
Well, if we start at the level of a national economy and we think about the crafting its markets, or trying to, and the interaction of that with an international economy, right? The international economy could either be a constraint or a help, right? I mean, in other words, that the international economy, and particularly U.S. and Japan, we're talking about big, large countries, right? There are some countries that are so interpenetrated with the international market and have so little control over the global rules that they have to, that major parts of their kind of market craft experience are kind of givens. Does that make sense? And so they have to work within those constraints. But they can also be opportunities, right? In other words, that if there's, again, if there's an international movement to promote telecommunications reform or financial reform, those interests within the country who believe in that can try to use that pressure or that influence to push it in a positive direction, right? To move towards a better versus a worse version of that. Now, I think that chisels at your question, but doesn't get at the heart of it, which is that, okay, but should some of this be done at the multilateral level? And I think it's very, you know, to be honest, it's very difficult, right? Because even a national actor doesn't have total control over there, right? An international actor has even less control over the global, right? So we would have to be modest. But if we kind of have the starting point, you know, could an international level improve global market craft? Sure, absolutely. And to the extent that it's a product of the global level, it would have to be at that level. I mean, the one real world example of market craft beyond the nation state that's gone the furthest is the EU, right? And they very much think in these terms, right? They think, what kind of competition policy, what kind of financial regulation will get us to the best crafted market at the European level? So in that sense, there's a real world experiment, you know, with its successes and failures out there to study.
To increase the scope at the more global level, to what degree do you think organizations like the UN, the WTO, how much more power would they have in comparison to what they have currently to be effective?
Well, this is obviously not a great moment for that. So if that's the direction, we're not moving in that direction at the moment. I'm certainly not advocating for world government. I think at the international multinational level, we have to be modest, right? We have to think like what are the issues that really need to be dealt with at a multilateral level, and where's the feasibility? But again, it's not impossible. Obviously, you know, Basel is an example, right? If you've got international coordination, right, and that's part of the financial microcraft is the Basel agreements. So it can be done. I think it could be done without creating a world government. I think at the level of the WTO as it existed a couple of years ago, you could, right? I mean, obviously these things would all be subject to hard-nosed negotiation among the partners, but I don't think it's impossible to imagine improvements in market craft. Maybe close to impossible right today, but not in the midterm future. Right?
Any other questions or comments?
Well, is it possible to talk a little bit more about womenomics, and is there such a thing, or is it really just labor reform, if it happens, take care of it?
Oh, I think womenomics is real. Okay. I mean, there's very different meanings of real, right?
Yeah, yeah. What do you mean?
I mean is movement in a positive direction.
Right.
That's what I mean. What I don't mean is solving the problem, okay. Right? Those are two very different bars, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe because my expectations are low, I'm actually optimistic, right? In other words, right, you got the equal employment in 1986, right? So it's been 30 years, right? Not a lot. I mean, some change, but not a lot.
Yeah.
I think that based compared to that glacial pace, I would say we're at a sprint right now. And you can see that in the numbers, right? Again, from a low base, you see increase, for instance, in female executives. It's not surprising that they're going to do the easiest things first. So, for example, one area where you're going to see more dramatic than female executives is going to be female directors, mm-hmm. right? That's obvious because a director, you can just appoint them, right? So again, we can make fun of that, but that's real change in the sense that, and I've talked to some of these female directors, they see themselves as agents of change, right? So if there's some really stupid male chauvinist policy, they can tell you, excuse me. Again, I'm not talking about a revolution, but I'm talking about both change that is real and that's an acceleration from, again, from a low base, from what you've seen in the past. You're also going to see an increase in female representation in the civil service. I think that'll make a difference. Some of these things are going to be slow just by their nature. There's a media official who said, I guess their target is 30% of the top civil service. That's not going to happen quickly, but that is definitely going to happen. And this is what he said to me. He says, because in terms of our entry classes, it's not even hard. I mean, there are more qualified women than we know what to do with. This is a no-brainer. Now, it takes a while for that to reach, but that is going to happen.
But they have to do the child care, the time, all the other things.
Right. So child care, same thing. It depends on your expectation, but it's getting better. Not as quickly as a lot of people would like. In the case of the child care, the public child care, it's actually, there's a geographical issue, right? It's that all the backlogs are in the big cities. So it's, I'm not trying to defend the Japanese government, because to me, I think my intuition is like yours. This seems like the ultimate no-brainer, like, get with it. But they are getting there, albeit a lot slower than you want to think. I mean, in terms of child care leaves, the policies are pretty good. I mean, but like paternity leave, nobody takes it, right? We've got this great policy, but that relates very much to your question, right? Because they're scared too, because they think real men don't take paternity leave. But so there's been a lot of progress on the policy, and I think things are moving, again, maybe not dramatically, but in terms of, it's a positive direction, not a negative one. And that's good.
All right. Well, please join me in thanking Professor Fogel for a very engaging conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And just a pitch and reminder that his book is available up here. Probably he'll be kind enough to sign it for you, I bet, too. So, all right. Thanks
very much.
Yeah.